joined in studio by Nolene Eustace, who's the mother of Kelvin Brennan. Kelvin was only 26 years of age when he took his own life by suicide in May this year. And Nolene is here to tell us because how all her efforts to get help for her son, and I'm looking at a beautiful photograph of him now, and Nolene will tell me a little bit more in a couple of minutes about her story, which was raised in the Dáil only yesterday by Sinn Féin senator. Let's find out more now in regards to that. Nolene, you're very welcome and thank you for coming to studio.
Morning, how are you?
First of all, our deepest sympathy to you, and I know that words will never, if you move just a little bit closer to that microphone, I know that words will never, ever make up for the pain and sorrow that you're encountering in losing your lovely son.
Correct, yeah.
Tell me a little about him first.
Kelvin was funny, very, very empathetic. They say people with Asperger's don't have empathy. Kelvin had empathy to the point where it would have been painful for him. Yeah, loved by his nieces and nephews. Intelligent. Had a wide range of friends. Had a girlfriend for 5 years. Really struggled in school, but always wanted to get back into education, and during COVID did his level 4 and then recently finished his level 5. Wanted to go to college. He died actually 2 days after finishing his level 5 in community and social care, and he wanted to go to college, but he said he'd give himself a year out. I wanted to work with people, and had an interview actually with Camp Hill on the Tuesday after he died.
Okay. And a good-looking young man.
Very good-looking, yeah.
As I see in the photograph there.
That's his sister with him.
That's his sister, is
yeah,
it? Right.
His only sister.
How many in the family?
Just him and her.
Just him and her. Okay. In the Shan, it's Senator Nicole Ryan of Sinn Féin carried the testimony of your son. She urged the government to ensure the Mental Health Bill delivers real change with joined-up services, proper funding and laws that protect lives. She claimed that for years that your son was passed from pillar to post.
Yep.
Tell me about, go back to the beginning.
Yeah, I'll go back to the big beginning. I noticed, Kelvin, there was something not right very, very early on. And I'll go back to literally when he started feeding. I had to change his food 6 times because he just couldn't get on with certain formulas. I now know that was sensory processing disorder. He was having night terrors about 18 months, banging his head off the cot, flinging himself out of the cot, rigid on the floor, brought him to the public health nurse when he was 2, brought him to my GP, serious concerns because he wasn't like my daughter. Roll on a few years.
Now, before you go on, what's sensory processing disorder?
It's, you know, you have your senses. So basically a food would be a sense. And if you can't tolerate a food, your body rejects that when you have sensory processing disorder. So, for instance, I would eat chicken nuggets. You might not be able to tolerate the texture of chicken nuggets. And it causes them to emotionally unregulate and it upsets their system.
Right. Now, that's as a baby.
As a baby.
Right.
Banging his head in the cot, banging, banging, banging.
And were you happy at that time that you were being told by the medical world exactly what was wrong or
no,
what was going on?
No, I knew there was serious stuff going on here.
You're his mother and you know and mothers know.
Yeah, he never
slept. By instinct.
He never slept. He never slept. And right up till his death, he never slept. We never slept.
Really?
Never slept. Which is common. Common with people with Asperger's. Never slept. I never got a good night's sleep.
Right, you said that's as a baby. Move on a couple of years then.
That continued and continued.
Starting school and so on.
Starting school, it even got, he'd be grand in school, one or two little small issues, but as we know, I did my dissertation on this in college, as we know then, they hold it and when they come home, they let it all out. So we witnessed the real you know, the trauma and the upset for Kelvin. So he'd be very, very upset at home. Homework was an issue. Noise in the house was even an issue, you know. And that's another sensory issue, you know, noise. Mm-hmm. Television on in the background, you know. I even stopped shopping and done stores. I couldn't go in there because of the noise. We couldn't go in. So that continued. And, you know, did fairly okay in primary school, but there was definitely, you know, we had a few deaths in our family and one had ended up in rainbows. But he took everything to the extreme. Like, he was obsessed with death and dying to the point where it just wasn't normal for a child that age. And CAMHS would have kind of hooked onto that. So it sidetracked them. To be honest with you, the mother gets blamed. That's what happens. The mother gets blamed. And they didn't blame me, but they didn't not. You need to do more. You need to do this. You need to do that. To be honest with you, I should have been given a medal for what I was dealing with to try and keep my family together, because it was really, really difficult. So then going into secondary school, he was 13, and this is when it got really difficult for him. So you're talking sensory process and Asperger's. They can't read facial expression or find it difficult even to read my face. He'd say to me, are you saying that, Ma? What do you mean? So you go into a school where there's 800 students and you have 800 faces running up and down a hallway and lockers banging. And then that's when he said he couldn't handle it. He was so overwhelmed. And he hadn't been diagnosed at this stage. And this is when the diagnosis came. He told me he was going to commit suicide. Now, he'd still been in CAMHS.
What age was he at that?
13.
He told you at 13 he was going to commit suicide.
He was going to commit suicide. And I went to my GP and the GP said, wait and talk to CAMHS. And I said, no, I'm going to an emergency department now. And I went to Temple Street and met a fabulous psychiatrist in Temple Street, and she spoke to him. We got him right in the moment. She spoke to him for 2 hours, so he must have let it all out. I wasn't there. I only went in at the end, and she wrote an urgent referral back to CAMHS in Athy.
CAMHS is the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service.
Yeah. She wrote an urgent referral back to him. And at this point, the school were on board. I have to say, his school were amazing.
Which was?
PBS in Newbridge.
Fair play.
Absolutely amazing. They really turned a key for me. They organised an assessment with an educational psychologist, which opened another door. And he said to me, your son has Asperger's, but I cannot clinically diagnose him because I'm an educational psychologist. So I then went and got money and went to a speech and language therapist and a psychologist, and he was diagnosed with Asperger's, generalised anxiety, sensory processing and dyspraxia.
Just all of that.
All of that. And then on top of that, you had bullying.
And any one of those on its own is enough. And the bullying, that would be peer bullying, I presume, you mean?
Because he was different, because he couldn't manage his environment.
Okay, what age was he roughly when he was diagnosed?
13.
13. And
so I was 8 years going to CAMHS. 8 years, back and forth, dealing with no sleeping, little eating. At one stage, my son was a stone and a half underweight because of the eating issues. He would only eat certain foods. I used to send him into school with, this is no word of a lie, a bread roll and white pudding. It's all he would eat. But as a mother, you don't care. I would send him with five of them a day if I had to, because he wasn't eating for me.
By the way, just to tell listeners, we're actually live streaming this as well, if anybody hasn't just access to audio or whatever else, and it will be repeated this evening. Right, from there.
From there, he got the diagnosis of, as I said, and then I thought the world would open up for us. Mm-hmm. It didn't. I got a one-line report from CAMHS. Kelvin has a diagnosis of Asperger's. That was it. So I went, right, okay, what do I do with that? There's nothing for you. There's nothing for somebody. There's no, like, with somebody who has Down syndrome, they can go into a service, the disability services. With Asperger's, there's nowhere for them. There's nowhere for them.
Nothing?
Nothing. No. You go, I basically went and found whatever I could myself. I did courses with Middletown Centre for Autism. Amazing. I went up and I did courses with them. I educated them, myself on it. I read Tony Atwood's book, Asperger's. I did my dissertation in college on the impact of raising a child with Asperger's and found out loads around the history of Asperger's, how to treat it. If I had been armed with them facts when he was five, the outcome may have been better for him in many ways, because I wouldn't have pushed him into a school where there was 800 students if I'd have known.
But you were just following the
norm. I was following what they were saying, but I kept saying to them, this is not normal. The things that were going on in my house, the way he was obsessed with debt, it just wasn't normal. My daughter had lost family members. She wasn't behaving the way he did. He was obsessed with fireworks. I used to have to get him fireworks, and the psychiatrist was in on this because it was a risk, because he actually could make his own fireworks. So we used to get him fireworks, and he'd get them for Christmas. He loved fireworks. But now I know, again, that was a sensory piece. It was the lights. It was the, and I know that might sound contradictory to noise. He zoned in on the lights. And when someone has Asperger's or autism, it might be numbers, it might be letters. But when they're in that happy land of what, that was his happy piece. That was, you know, to the point where somebody even put a firework on his grave to, you know, they knew what he liked.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation empathy and how empathetic he was. Mm. And for those who don't maybe understand empathy, it's basically being able to appreciate, understand and maybe feel the feelings of others.
Yeah.
As he was going through school, what was his relationship with you? Did he express love for you?
I've notes at home. I've letters at home. I found one recently when I was going through his stuff at home. And this was common. Ma, I'd find it on the landing. I'd be in bed. He'd be finally after getting to sleep. Ma, I love you so much and thank you so much for everything you have done for me and tried to do for me. That was regular. That was regular. And I know that my son died by suicide to end his pain. I know, he told me, we spoke about this. My son spoke about it. And this is the thing around people who die by suicide. My son spoke and told me, he told people around him. He told the services, I will die. He wanted help. My son didn't want to put that pain on us. I know that. I know that. He said to me, Ma, I'll never do it. I'll never do it. He told me that. And I know his love for me, his love for his sister, his love for his girlfriend, his father, his nieces and nephews. He arranged on the Monday to bring my granddaughter to McDonald's. He loved them. And I used to say to him, your life may have been difficult, but try and make the next generations better. Be there for your nephew, be there for your grand or your niece. And I knew he wanted to do that.
It's an incredible expression of love, isn't it?
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable. And they say people with Asperger's can't love or don't have empathy. No, his was actually to the point where I would have said it was painful. He painfully loved.
As he moved into his further teenage years then, throughout those from 13 onwards and up into his early 20s, trace that for us.
When he was 16, he ended up New Year's Eve night telling me again he was suicidal. And my daughter went and got him. I was working in Dublin at the time. And she went and got him with her friend. And we got him to NACE. And he told them there that he was suicidal, that he was going to end his life. And they refused to give him a bed. And
why?
He didn't meet the criteria, they said. Now, the criteria is you're a risk to yourself and others. And because he was a child, they didn't want him in an adult unit, which I understand.
Fair enough.
I understand. So I brought him home. I was lying on one couch and he was lying on the other. And he tapped me on the shoulder and said, I'm going to do it. So I had to go back exhausted. And I said, here I go again, because I knew they weren't going to. And we ended up back again. And I said, I can't mind him. I'm on my own. I can't mind him. I can't stay awake. I can't mind him. I need you to do something here. So I actually had to go legal to get them to take him. And I'm telling you, that was some battle. We were, I'd say, 10 hours I was 10 hours trying to keep him quiet in A&E, in a hallway, on a bed, holding him, hugging him, trying to get him in there. Now, I did not want to put my child into an adult unit, but I had no choice because he could die that night on me. And my daughter begged me not to put him in there, but I had no choice.
He was aged?
16.
16.
I had no choice. I couldn't mind him.
Was he still going through secondary school?
Yeah. No, at this stage, he was nearly gone. School refusal. We had home tuition. He was nearly gone at this stage. He'd done very well. I was looking at his school reports. Done very well, kind of up till kind of halfway through first year, and then it started to slide. But we got him through the junior cert.
We'll talk about, continue this conversation in just a moment. I want to talk about you for a minute. Because listening to your story there, I can't even conceive of how you coped.
I ended up in front of mental health services myself. I was going to drive the car into a wall on the M7 with him and me in it. And then I said, this is not right. I have a daughter. I have grandkids. This is not right. And I dropped him home that morning. And I ended up in front of a psychiatrist in Nace Hospital. And I told them what I had taught, what I wanted to do. And I ended up then in Tuasnua in Kildare Town. And this is exactly what I was told. Get rid of the stress out of your life. Get rid of the stress out of your life. The stress was my son, and it wasn't his fault. He'd been abandoned. I wasn't going to get rid of him. I wasn't going to put him out. Do you know, it wasn't his fault he wasn't diagnosed. I loved him and I wanted to get the best for him.
And he loved you.
And he loved me.
So obviously.
Yeah, adored me.
I can't take my eyes off that photograph with him and his sister. It's such a beautiful photograph. Two of the most handsome children I might add.
Yeah.
And what age is your daughter?
My daughter's 32.
How was she coping?
Devastated.
Through all of this period? Because it had to have a massive impact.
My daughter left home at 17. And I know now, I'm a social care worker. Families break down. My daughter left home and I have had to apologise to her even when Kelvin was alive because my eye was constantly on him. And I have said to her, I am sorry, but I did my best with the tools I had and with no support. My mother and father were passed away. My sisters were working. I had very little support. And any support I did get, I paid for. I was in psychotherapy for 12 years paying for it, trying to stay sane. And he was in private therapy too. And I offered my daughter therapy. We were trying to keep it together. But I did. I had to apologise to her for... I couldn't go to an Irish dancing fesh for her.
But she had to be a remarkable woman.
Very strong
woman
girl.
Herself.
In a lot of ways. Yeah, she is remarkable. And she's 5 children herself now. She was like a mother to him at times because that's what happens when there's no father in the... She was like a mother to him at times. And at times, I often giggle about this, she was harder on him than I was. She wouldn't put up with his nonsense sometimes as well, you know. But she even said that she didn't realise that it would end like this. I knew it would. I knew if we didn't get to a finish line, I knew it would. I knew deep down it would.
Okay, let's move on then into, we'll say, 18, legally an adult, and those years between 18 and 26 until last May.
Yeah. The struggle I had to get him from the child adolescence into the adult mental health services was excruciating. It was horrendous. To the point where I had to write to the Minister for Health at the time and put a complaint into Nace Hospital asking who was going to pick up. Nobody was picking up my son between 17 and 18. It took me 9 months to get somebody to pick him up in services. 9 months. And that was between putting a complaint in, a letter to the Minister for Health at the time, which I didn't even get a reply from, and constantly ringing to us new in Kildare. And I was told very, very clearly, your son is not an urgent case. I says, my son is suicidal. He's just coming from young people to adult and nobody's picking up the tab here.
You were told your son was not an urgent case.
I have it in an email.
This is after... From babyhood in the cradle up to now where he's, 18, 19?
Yeah, and I have it in an email. And things were getting worse. Things were getting really bad. to the point where his emotional regulation was getting worse. I mean, he was really, really, really unwell at home. Really unwell at home.
What was he doing at this stage in those years? Now he's left school. He doesn't have the anchor of what that would have been for him.
And he felt bad about finishing school with no education.
Yeah.
He was really upset about that. He started to self-harm at home. So he started to self-harm, and at this point he was abusing substances as well. Now, not daily, but when he was abusing them, I did not know what way he was going to be, because again, with the sensory processing piece, somebody who would take cocaine who has sensory processing disorder wouldn't go up, they go down. Mm-hmm. So he was abusing substances at this point.
And this continued through 18...
Nothing changed, it just got worse, yeah.
Into his 20s.
Into his 20s, yeah. Right up till he died. Right up till he died. Yeah, it just got worse and worse and worse.
And still no help?
No, all we got was... there's no CBT with community mental health.
This is cognitive behavioural therapy, I presume.
Yeah, so we went private and we paid somebody, and he was with her for the last 4 years, and he had a really good relationship with her. But he knew not to tell her that he was going to do this, because that's the contract you have. But there was nothing available community mental health wise apart from going to a psychiatrist where there could be 60 patients. It's like a holding pen. 60 patients, and you're given a prescription and sent home.
So he's telling you on a daily basis that he's going to take his life.
Yeah.
Since he was a young boy.
Young boy, basically.
He's saying
this. Yeah.
You've been stonewalled by the services.
Yeah.
You're not getting help from him.
No.
So take me now through the period of May of this year.
I need to go back to April first.
Okay.
Because in April he sat me down 3 o'clock in the morning and said to me, I am suicidal every day. He said to me, will you assist me in suicide by bringing me to Switzerland? And I said, Kelvin, I can't.
This, for listeners who mightn't understand that reference, is a reference to Dignitas, that where people can go and have their lives ended via medical means. It's not legal in this country, but it is legal in Switzerland.
Yeah.
So he said this to you.
Yeah, so he'd obviously researched.
How did you react to that? Did you just feel...
I felt total despair and sadness that I couldn't help him. Help him live. I didn't want to help him to die. I wanted to help him to live. I wanted to see him living like any normal other human being, because he had it in him. He might have flipped and flopped along the way, but I knew he had it in him. And he was after doing his course for the year and had his car and had his girlfriend, and I had, visions for his life. And I went, is it that bad? And he said, yeah. And I said, I understand. He said, no, you don't. You do not understand. He says, what I'm living with on a daily basis. I'm living with suicidal ideation. I'm living with, I see 3 of your faces some days. I see 5 of your hands. I can't handle noise. He said, I just can't do it anymore.
You see, I'm juxtapositioning this on his absolute mental turmoil and desperation and hopelessness. And on the other hand, how much he loved you.
Yeah, I know he didn't want to die.
And he's crying for help.
Crying for help, and I couldn't fix that. If a social care worker, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I was not a professional in that area that could help him. He needed to go in somewhere.
Obviously, you're an incredibly tough, and I say that in the kindest, and people listening to it will share that thought. You're an incredible woman. And I'm loath to even maybe ask you this question, but we're doing this interview in the hope that it will help others.
Mm.
Tell me about when you got the news that Kelvin had finally ended his life.
I knew there was something wrong, and I rang his phone and there was no answer. But this was common for me. I'd be ringing and texting, always wondering and waiting, was it going to be something? And I said to his father, there's something not right. It was too silent. So I actually drove to where he was, and the Garda car drove past me, and I said, he's gone.
Where was he?
Cadeen Hotel.
Any And he had taken his life.
And I drove in and the ambulance was there and I said, he's gone. He's gone. And I knew when I entered the hallway, they just looked at me and I said, it's over. One chapter's over, but another has begun, you know.
That being the one that has begun, what? Your campaign to get justice for him, maybe?
The pain in some ways was gone. The hardship for him was gone. But
what about you?
The pain I went through in all them years, I wouldn't treat anybody like that. There's another type of pain. I wish I could bring him back. And then I often think, is that selfish of me to put somebody through that turmoil? But I think it was selfish of the system and the failures of the state. You wouldn't treat a dog like that. Not a dog. It was abusive on so many levels and traumatic for him to keep looking for help. And nobody said, it's okay, come in, we'll look after you. Nobody, only me and my family. We knew, I knew. An adult child lying beside you in the bed and you're holding them, trying to keep them safe, and no one else wanted to do that. Nobody, only a psychotherapist who listened to him, his friends. His friends were very good, they all knew. I tell you, I don't like the idea of this, but it's who he was. His friends put a plaque on his grave, boys, I'm psychotic. Oh no, boys, I'm in a psychosis. That's on his grave. That's how much he talked about it. Now that's, you know, you don't see that on a grave very often, boys, I'm in a psychosis. He never stopped talking about being in a psychosis. Yeah. So in some ways, the pain is over for him. I can actually sleep at night, to a degree. Not afraid of opening the door and seeing what I can find, because I found him once. And I got to him on time. And he was brought to the Garda station in Newbridge. And the psychiatrist gave him a letter for A&E, and he said, I'm not going there. And I couldn't blame him. I couldn't blame him, because they wouldn't let him in so many times. They wouldn't let him in. And he came home. And every day after that, I'd open the door and say, is he going to be here? Am I going to find him? Or if I was out, I'd send him a text and say, do you want chocolate in Tesco? Just hoping he'd answer the phone to me. I wouldn't even be bothered about the chocolate. I just want to know, is he going to answer me? Like, living with that on a daily basis and every door shut in your face, like. And then when you get annoyed in this hospital, you're escorted out by security and laughed at. And all you're trying to do is keep your baby alive. Child. Horrendous, horrendous. But I'm not the only one. The amount of people that have contacted me is unbelievable, to say that is still going on. You know?
Who's taking care of you?
My family are very, very good to me. I'm out of work, obviously, because I'm not able to go into work at this moment in time the way I am. I am trying to look after myself. As I say, I'm a social care worker, so who cares for the carer? So I'm trying to care for myself. I am seeing a psychologist. I'm attending HUG, which is the National Organisation for Those Bereaved by Suicide. And just trying to mind myself.
And the government's new mental health bill has passed the Dáil and is now before the Senate. Senator Ryan, the Sinn Féin senator, and you sat in the Dáil listening to her yesterday, I think it was, said that the services must be joined up with funding that matches our words, quote unquote.
And I was in the Shannon the other day, and what Minister Mary Butler is proposing, there won't be any door open for my son in that. My son had dual diagnosis. She actually said the other day, on record, what is dual diagnosis? And I went, did she actually say that? And she said it a number of times. And then you have Trump's comment on autism and Tylenol.
Oh, we've dealt with that, yeah. I tell you, during the week.
So between the two, my concern is you have a president of the United States and Mary Butler, Minister for Mental Health, or Junior Minister, stating what is dual diagnosis and Tylenol around autism. They're people that are making decisions for our country, and nowhere in that mental health amendment or what's being discussed at the minute in the Senate, nowhere is dual diagnosis mentioned. And she said, I am chief whip. I'm not chief whip for nothing. This is on record. I will get this bill passed. And I'm sitting in the gallery thinking, well, Mary, I'm chief whip in my home and my son is dead, as well as many more. I'm not going to name names on air, but the people that have contacted me. And you're not going to put dual diagnosis into this, which Sinn Féin have looked for, which is, we all know that drugs is and mental health is ravaged our country. They're not looking at that going into that bill. And the problem with Kelvin is that the amendment she's looking at, and some of them are brilliant, regulating CAMHS, that's brilliant. But the problem with my son and two more that I can think of, one of them, their brother was on to me this morning, they couldn't get a bed. If you can't get a bed for a serious issue like that, if my son had presented with diabetes, they would have treated him. If my son had presented with a broken leg, they would have treated him. You don't go to a hospital 60 times in 1 year and not get treated. There's something wrong.
You're an amazing woman. Your resilience is absolutely incredible. I can only describe you as a warrior. And he'd be so proud of you. And I say that in the sincerest terms. If Kelvin were listening to you now, he'd be so proud of you and he'd express love for you so often. He'd say, that's my mother.
Yeah. And he did. He said that living. I know. He idolised me, as he did his girlfriend and his sister. But you know, in the end, he actually hated me. Because he didn't want to die. The last few days, there was a lot had happened and he was so unwell. And that's why I couldn't have him in the house that last night. It was the first time I put him out. Because he was so unwell, I was afraid I was going to go with him. I thought he was going to hurt some of us. And he felt despair. I know he felt despair because he wouldn't want to behave like that. And he felt despair. He didn't want to hurt us.
The purpose of this interview was to basically pay tribute in many ways to Kelvin and his struggle. And particularly to his mam, Nolene Eustace of Newbridge. And to help those out there who might be struggling. And we constantly say on this programme, if you are, reach out please. Reach out. The Samaritan Suicide Prevention Helpline number is 1850 60 90 90. There are a series of numbers. Men's Aid 01 554 3811. As statistics reveal that 4 in 5 suicides are men. And often young men, as in Kelvin. Kelvin took his own life in May of this year. Kelvin Brennan, 26 years of age. His mother has, in the most articulate manner, recounted his and her struggle. Hopefully, this will mark a turn in that particular road. Nolene Eustace, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For your bravery and courage in telling us this story, Kelvin's story this morning. And we wish you the absolute best in caring for yourself.
Thank you very much.